Next speaker we have is Bruce Epperson. Now we've gone to folk, we've gone to jazz, we've gone to blues, and now we're going to discuss jazz discography sort of briefly here. The name Bruce Epperson may be familiar to regular ARSC members because he runs the question and answer column in the ARSC Journal and does an amazing job. He's an attorney, he's a writer, he's a member of ARSC's Fair Use and Copyright Committee. He writes the legal update section of the ARSC Journal's regular Fair Use and Copyright section. He's been recognized by Fine Books and Collections magazine, as I found this fascinating, having one of the largest private collections of discographies in the country. What better experience than to give the subject he's going to give now, which is about his book, More Important Than Music, A History of Jazz Discovery, Discography, excuse me, which will be published in September by University of Chicago Press. And are we ready to go, Bruce? Thank you.
The first known use of the word discography was by Compton Mackenzie, editor of the magazine Gramophone, in an editorial that appeared in January 1930. Discographies, mostly classical, mostly as sidebars to feature articles, appeared in the Gramophone fairly frequently. But starting in the mid-1930s, Edgar Jackson used them in his new popular music column, in Dance and Popular Rhythmic Music. One problem Jackson repeatedly discussed was the inability of record buyers to get accurate information about the music they were listening to. In the words of one critic, the record companies told you nothing, and as soon as sales slowed to a walk, they lose the masters, let them deteriorate, or even destroy them. One answer had come from jazz record collectors, who kept secretive little black books to help them sort through the piles of often deliberately mislabeled records they sorted through in junk shops or in the used bins in the back of record stores. Now, both English and French jazz fans like to form hot clubs, but unlike the Continentals, the English clubs focused almost exclusively on records, not promoting live music. As Ernest Borneman recalled, their utter dependence upon phonograph records has to be remembered, cut off from the living music by time as well as by space. The collector submits to a peculiar shift of values. The record becomes more important than the music. But the first book-length discography was actually by an American, R.D. Darrell. His Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia, which appeared in February 1936, was actually a classical music discography. But Darrell had been so taken by the work of Duke Ellington that he wrote that it would be stupid indeed, arbitrarily, to rule out a considerable number of works of this type. Alas, Ellington was deleted from all subsequent editions of the encyclopedia, which were edited by others. Although derided, Hilton Schliemann's Rhythm on Record deserves to be considered the first book-length discography. A publicity man for United Artists Films, he was an amateur collector, although his was supposedly among the best in Britain. Its publisher, Melody Maker, planned to print an edition of 1,500 copies, followed by annual updates. But the initial print run did not sell out, and the project died. Schliemann himself turned to collecting cigarette cards. 3 months later, Charles Delaunay published his famous Hot Discography. Before becoming famous as a discographer, Delaunay was best known as the son of two famous artists, Robert and Sonia Delaunay. His own work doing graphics for a record importer eventually brought him into contact with Hughes Panisse, president of the Paris Hot Club. At the time, Panisse was writing for Jazz Tango Dancing and wanted to start his own magazine, but was woefully lacking in the necessary organizational skills. Delaunay, on the other hand, recalled one colleague, had the soul of a butterfly collector. They began Jazz Hot Magazine together in 1935. The first edition of Hot Discography, a light blue paperback, appeared in mid-1936. The print run was fairly small, probably about 1,000 copies. A much expanded yellow paperback version came out 2 years later. The book wasn't organized alphabetically. Instead, it followed something called an affinities of style approach. Delaunay was always accused of trying to use it to empirically support certain theories of jazz development that Panisse had advanced in his 1935 book, Le Jazz Hot, but he always denied it, even after he and Panisse had parted ways after World War II. In 1940 and 1943, Milt Gabler, owner of the Commodore Music Shop in New York City, republished Hot Discography. Gabler's main competitor was a man named Steve Smith, who ran the nearby HRS record shop. Smith had lent space in the HRS shop to two young men, Charles Edward Smith and William Ramsey, so that they could edit their new book, Jazzmen. It was, so the legend goes, intended to rebut the theories advanced by Panisse in his Le Jazz Hot. Delaunay was permitted during the war by the occupation authorities to publish an updated edition of Hot Discography in 1943 with, of course, all the English translations removed. After the war, with the help of Phil Schaap and George Avakian, he edited New Hot Discography, which was published in America by Criterion. It included something called the Discode, which was intended to provide a unique serial number for each issue. Alas, it was ahead of its time. Without computer technology, it was almost impossible to update or correct, and the discodes tended to get confused with matrix numbers. Delaunay made one last attempt, the Hot Discography Encyclopedic of 1951-52, co-authored with the Swiss-French discographer Kurt Mohr. Like the simultaneous jazz directory project of Dave Carey and Albert McCarthy, it attempted to move through the alphabet in short volumes, keeping each book up to date. It also met the same fate, drowning in what Albert McCarthy would later call the flood of new recording and playback technologies. Immediately after the war, Orrin Blackstone embarked on his Index to Jazz. Now, Blackstone had been a successful New Orleans newspaper editor, but gave it up to start a record shop, publish a jazz magazine, write a collector's column for Gordon Gullickson's Record Changer, and even produce his own small record label. It was Gullickson who agreed to underwrite the publishing of the four thin volumes of the Index to Jazz. Blackstone got them out on schedule in about 3.5 years, mostly by omitting many details and rigidly sticking to a single 1944 cutoff date for new issues. When he attempted a second edition that stayed current with all new releases, he also drowned in the flood, never getting farther than the letter E. He abandoned jazz and returned to newspaper work. Had he been permitted but 3 more years of effort, rude historian Paul Sheetsley, his work would have become the standard reference for jazz discography up to the year 1950. During the 1940s and 1950s, jazz publishing was dominated by Downbeat and Metronome in the US and by Melody Maker in Britain. But there emerged a slew of new, small, and often short-lived specialty magazines, especially in England. Among the most prolific of the small journal editor publishers was Albert McCarthy, who, along with Max Jones, edited Jazz Forum. About 1946, McCarthy was asked by Dave Carey, the owner of the famous Swing Shop record store, to help him compile a new discography that he was trying to assemble. The official title always varied over the years, but it has always been known by its cover title, The Jazz Directory. There was a third member of the Jazz Directory team, Ralph Venables, but he disappeared after the first volume. He had sent a fake article to a small magazine called Jazzology, supposedly written by a fictitious Bix Beiderbecke ciderman named Shep Landis, after George Simon repeated some of its details in his Hot Box discography column. Venables actually wrote to Simon, boasting about how he had put one over on him in the other big magazines. Simon, known for his prickly demeanor, was the wrong man to cross. Venables spent the rest of his days editing a motorcycle magazine. The Jazz Directory folded in 1955 after 6 volumes. McCarthy alone tried to resurrect the project by issuing Jazz Discography 1958, a single-year discography. But it wasn't even ready until 1961, and as you would expect, it didn't sell. Brian Rust began preparing discographies for small jazz journals in the early 1940s. Originally a bank clerk, by the time he went to work for the BBC Music Library in 1945, at age 23, he was already known as the Sage of Edgware. In 1951, he traveled to the US where he met Richard C. Allen. They co-wrote King Joe Oliver in 1955.
Walter Allen.
Thank you. I had to correct that at least 3 times in the galley proofs of the book. The first edition of his jazz records, A to Z, appeared in 1962. It went through 6 editions, never going past 1942, never covering anything other than 78 RPM singles. After his first edition, Rust dropped blues music from Jazz Records A to Z, choosing instead to underwrite John Godrich and R.W. Dixon's Blues and Gospel Music. Now in its 4th edition, it has turned out to be the most scholarly of the big discographies because it covers so many non-commercial field recordings collected by the Lomax family for the Library of Congress, and by Ben Bodkin's WPA Writers Program Folklife Project during the 1930s. Initially far less successful was Mike Ledbetter and Neil Slavin's 1968 discography of modern blues. A massive 6-volume follow-up was originally planned, but Mike Ledbetter died in 1974. Slavin, along with Les Fancourt, did get out the 2-volume set of Mainstream Blues, but even that part of the project took 26 years. A Canadian specialty publisher has since successfully taken over that portion of the project. Rust also agreed to move the cutoff date of his Jazz Records A to Z forward by over a decade to match the start of a new modern jazz discography by Jorgen Grunet Jepsen, an editor at Orchestra Journal and Magazine. He was already a prolific compiler of small chapbook discographies. Jepsen also tried to move his inclusion date forward as he progressed through each volume. As a result, he needed 11, not the initially planned 8 volumes, and the project required over 10 years. He couldn't have finished had it not been for the patience and the generosity of his patron and publisher, jazz impresario Carl Emil Knutson. It was Knutson's death in 2003 that probably finally doomed the most ambitious discographic project ever undertaken, Eric Robbins' update to Jepsen's Jazz Records. In 35 years of work, only 8 volumes were issued, one of those only in CD. The project only progressed as far as the letter G. Walter Breunig's 50 years of recorded jazz and the follow-up 60 years of recorded jazz were both sold by subscription as thousands of loose, unbound sheets. Most surviving copies, such as this 22-volume set with 11,000 pages, which include the addendum pages, were privately bound. 50 Years in particular was execrated, especially in Lori Wright's Storyville magazine, for its poor production quality and plagiarism. 60 Years, on the other hand, was notably better. In the 1980s, the Japanese magazine Swing Journal sponsored the publication of a 35-volume set of paperbacks that were extracted from 60 Years. They were distributed in North America by Cadence Magazine. Now, Cadence was owned by Bob Rausch. In 1982, Rausch had started a record company, Cadence Records, with a former manufacturing executive named Tom Lord. In 1991, they began a 35-volume comprehensive discography series called The Jazz Discography. Like 50 years of jazz, controversy ensued, especially in 1995, when Barry Kernfield and Howard Rye, in an article in the academic journal Notes, accused Lord of simply copying most of the material in his early volumes out of Breunig's Swing Journal paperbacks. After the series was finished in 2000, Lord switched to a CD-ROM format, then in 2008 to an online format. Whatever your opinions about Lord's project, and let me warn you that there are two sides to this story. I believe the one thing that it will be remembered primarily for is this. This was the first large-scale discographic project to be conceived, planned, organized, and managed from day one to be a rationalized, profit-making business proposition. I'm afraid I've only covered about two-thirds of my new book. I've had to leave out the fascinating world of specialized discographies, including the single label works of Michael Rupley and his associates, the bio discographies of Chris Sheridan, Bob Porter, and many others, and a multitude of topical works, including national discographies, genre discographies, and instrument-based discographies. Equally important, I've had to skip over the exploding world of digital and online discographies such as Edvard, which are rapidly reconceptualizing the idea of what a discography is and what a discography can do. Instead, let me leave you with this 1963 photo, which was taken during one of Brian Rust's visits to the United States, with a tip of my hat to our host, to my fellow presenters, and to our AV assistants. I thank you very much.
It'll show itself on.
Okay. Thanks, Bruce. That was great. Just another point to show you all the connections that go in ARSC. Walter's son, Dan, comes every year, is sitting here as a longtime member of ARSC. So it's interesting between Malcolm's Tommy Rockwell connection and Walter Dan's connection. Okay, if there's any questions, we'll take them. Bill Klinger has the microphone to come at to you. Please wait until he gets to you so we can get it on recording. Are there any questions? None? Okay. Oh, Mike has one. Wait till the mic, Mike.
Okay, I'll use my usual bitch. How come Brian Rust doesn't like prefixes, matrix prefixes? I know his answer, but what's the real story?
I have found, as far as I know, the story that he gives is the real answer. I don't think there are any deep, dark secrets. It's just the style that he prefers to use. His preference is, and there is in some discussion, his preference, his discographic methodological belief is, his job is to evaluate the data, make his judgment as the expert as to what the truth is, and then present that as an unambiguous presentation of the truth. And once it's presented, it is the truth. And your job as a discographer is to know more than anybody else, make the judgment, and present it. As Alan Sutton has said, and I think he, during an interview, put this better than anyone else, the discography of the future will have to be session 123 on this date at this place. Source 1 says Smith played trumpet. Source 2 says Jones played trumpet. Source 3 says Brown played trumpet. And a discography will simply be an encyclopedia of where the information has come from, because none of the information prior to the microgroove era truly is information. It's all expert judgment.
Thank you. One of the things about the prefixes is that he talked about is that if it tells where the location of the recording was made, such as the Columbia series of prefixes, it would be included. And he doesn't care whether it was an electrical or an acoustical recording. So that's why the VE doesn't get included. That's why the W doesn't get included. The problem is, those things do make a difference. And there's a lot of information that you can get out of the record prefixes.
Often because the information he had available was contradictory or incomplete, and he will not present incomplete or contradictory information.
It's there in the ledgers. In those cases, it's there in the ledgers. The only contradictory information is for 2 or 3 months in 1925. And as to which were the first electrical recordings at Victor comes from a 1953 letter. And that's the only period of time where the Victor ledgers are inconsistent on the prefixes.
Thank you, Mike. There's a question in the back. Bill?
There's a project being talked about in England about reissuing one of the Brian Rust discographies. And it would be a tremendous work, of course, but with computer optical recognition, which would speed up the business altogether. And remember that Brian Rust typed it all out on a manual typewriter. But there is a controversy about whether there is a copyright by his publisher, and that reproducing the information using the original Brian Rust books as the source material, whether it is convening, it's creating some copyright problem, bearing in mind Brian Russell got the information from the ledgers and from the record labels, sort of, does it belong to anybody? Or is it free for use for everybody? Have you any thoughts about that, please?
The this is discussed in the book quite a bit. After all, I'm an attorney that works with copyright. The state of the law in both England and the United States is that data, straight information, cannot be copyrighted. So far, the best legal determination is that no amount of research work, that is digging through a file to find information, amounts to making a analysis and therefore makes it protectable. For instance, a used car guide that evaluates what the value, best of the value of a used car is. That data is protectable because an analysis has been made. A 2006 Dodge is worth X numbers of dollars. That's protectable. But no matter how much work you put into digging through the Victor blue card files, that does not make that data protectable. And how, on the other hand, I think we are approaching a limit on these Rust McCarthy style discographies simply because the origin, the economic origin and demand was for record collectors, particularly of 78s, and that market quite literally is dying away. And the new books that are being printed are not following that format because that information is not what is being demanded. Those were, what's being demanded now is more of a combination of either biographical or musicological. I think we're seeing the end of the era of the Rust format discography because the demand for that data is waning. There's only so much out there that was done prior to the era in which record companies maintained good information on what it is they were recording.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question back there.
Just one more, and it's more of a piece of information, I guess. Yeah. I co-authored a discography with Brian, as you probably know, Columbia Discography. He's a charming gentleman and very deferential and not argumentative, as at least in our correspondence. However, he had his way of doing things, and it turned out to be four volumes. Number one was by me, number two and three were by him, and number four
was by the two of us, but split down the middle, section one and section two, because we didn't agree on how to do discography. He came out of an era in the 1950s when they were pioneers. They were really digging this stuff out for the first time, and he did a lot of research. No, he didn't want to source it. No, he wasn't interested in showing alternatives as pioneers and the first ones to do it sometimes don't. And today, we look for a much more academic approach than that, I think, and sourcing and let the reader decide between perhaps controversies that are there. So we divided the book, and he was fine with that. He didn't mind. So I wouldn't in the least demean the work that he did, because he advanced in so many ways and was the first out there and was the basis for what so many others worked on, including myself. However, I think discography hopefully has moved beyond that, and now we have greater standards. Thank you.
Well, it says exactly 3 o'clock on the laptop clock up here, so I thank all our speakers. 3:30 back in this room, I think Jazz 3 continues. I hope you're all having a great conference, and those I haven't met before, stop by and say hi. Thanks again.